You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, hunters are being encouraged to get their deer tested for chronic wasting disease. We'll find out what's adding to a sense of urgency this year. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. The full state budget passed in the state assembly this week, and a last-minute airport in Wisconsin Rapids is proving controversial. Robert Menser is a senior statewide editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau, and he joins us every week to look back at some of the biggest news. Rob, good to have you back.
Well, thanks for having me back. It's good to be back.
Well, Rob, I want to start off with this story about an airport near Wisconsin Rapids, I should say. Tell us what's happening there.
Yeah, so this is sort of this is an interesting little microcosm of the way that sort of you know political debates can take shape. This is this little private airport. You know, rich people use it for their private planes or whatever. It's like a lot of these small airports that are all over the state, all over the country. The airport commission down there had asked for a bunch of money from the state to make improvements to the runways and other sort of the infrastructure of the airport, because south of Wisconsin Rapids, they had just opened this big world-class kind of golf course called Sand Valley Golf Resort. And it has just opened this year and is seen as, they're hoping that it will be a boon to the area's economy. And it has, in fact, boosted traffic to this airport quite a lot, and so they're trying to get some money. Now, this money for the airport was not included in Governor Walker's budget, despite these requests. And then late in the process, in the Joint Finance Committee, they put in $4 million for this tiny little private airport by Wisconsin Rapids. This became sort of a lightning rod. Very much a lightning rod, and was tied to the fact that the owner of Sand Valley Golf Resort is a Republican donor, and was sort of painted as a bit of cronyism in the state budget, and became a real focus of a lot of political attacks. And then in the meantime, you know, there's this sort of local folks who argue that it's actually a good, you know, a valuable use, that they really want this for economic development for the area.
And there's been reporting that there was some money allocated for this airport, but not till 2021, and then it got bumped up to this budget, and that seems like one of the things that caught people's attention.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, no, that's exactly right. It was going to happen. They made the case that it should sort of jump the line, and then in the end it did. There are a lot of airports, and there are a lot of projects, and there's probably a lot of uses of $4 million in taxpayer funds. You could even ask the question of whether the state ought to be subsidizing these little airports in the first place. It's not, these are for private planes. These are probably not places that you or I really would use in the first place. But of course they do subsidize them. And there was this sort of, non-cronyish argument for it. It's just a case where you can sort of paint it according to your political needs, I guess.
And Rob, before we leave this, what do we know about the donations that were made by the owner of the Sand Valley Golf Resort?
Well, I mean, so he is a big Republican donor, for sure. He's a significant donor. He's the kind of guy that lawmakers can pay attention to. The resort itself is this multi-million-dollar sprawling development that is a whole, you know, they sort of, you know, set it down in the middle of Wisconsin in order to be this big draw that, you know, is written up in the New York Times and so on and so forth. They also say, though, it is significant, I think, to say that according to, the assembly lawmaker from Wisconsin Rapids area, that he did not request this in the budget directly. It probably bears more reporting about who was communicating with whom, but it is the case that this is coming from, not necessarily from this guy directly. So, you can take it as you wish, I suppose.
So is this over as far as the flap about it? Is it going forward and that's the end of it? Or is there going to be any more sort of action taken on this?
Well, so, you know, I guess they're still debating the budget, so anything can happen. Looks like it's likely to get funded, and you know, if I'm honest, it seems to me like the sort of thing that probably dies down fairly quickly. I don't quite see how this becomes an election issue in 2018, but hey, who knows? Maybe it will be.
Talking to Robert Menser right now, senior statewide editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And Rob, earlier this week, two labor unions representing most of the production employees at Harley-Davidson say they've ended an agreement with the company. What happened?
Right. The United Steelworkers and another large union, the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, ended this partnership agreement that had stood for 22 years with Harley-Davidson. What does it mean? You know, the workers are still there. Harley-Davidson is still producing motorcycles, and the union contracts themselves do not change. But the fact that this partnership agreement, which had been strained at various times in that 22-year history, now is dissolved, does show the extent to which workers and management there have been at odds, and it does suggest that there could be a more conflict ahead.
And what does this mean most likely for Harley-Davidson employees? Do we know?
Well, you have to understand it in the context of sort of what is going on with Harley. So the idea of a partnership agreement is that union representatives have a role in the company's strategic decision making. And the unions who spoke after the partnership was dissolved said that has not been the case. So they talk about layoffs at the company, which is definitely a thing that Harley has gone through. They talk about the fact that Harley management has taken on temporary seasonal workers rather than hiring full-time union workers. Those temp workers get paid a lot less, and obviously the unions see that as sort of a loophole to try to undercut the unions, which it kind of is. And then the other thing that really strains this is Harley's decision in May to open a motorcycle assembly plant in Thailand. The company says that plant doesn't take away any U.S. jobs, but of course, if you are working in Tomahawk or Menominee Falls or whatever, you might well be worried about seeing the company shift these functions to an overseas facility.
And from the company's perspective, something I hadn't heard about, they're saying that riders in the country here are declining ridership and that it's taking off in Thailand, so it makes sense to have a company there, a facility there.
Right, and across Asia. This is the fact that Harley-Davidson is dealing with is not as many Americans are buying motorcycles, and in fact, pretty dramatically fewer. There's been a pretty steep decline. You know, so that has led to layoffs and furloughs for employees. And, of course, you know, the workers bear the brunt of those changes as the company tries to, figure out its strategy and perhaps target new markets or try to reverse that trend in the U.S. But, yeah, I mean, that is the underlying reality is they're not selling as many motorcycles in the U.S.
And for our last story today, Rob, new reporting out shows that Milwaukee County Sheriff, former Milwaukee County Sheriff David A. Clark's around-the-clock security detail has cost taxpayers over $200,000, and it looks like that may be ending at least mostly. What's happening there?
Right, yes. Clark, yeah, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel got some records and reported these figures this week that this year, so far this year, the taxpayers paid this amount, $226,000 for security. Now, you know, Clark has sort of styled himself as a kind of ultra-right-wing figure, unconditional supporter of President Trump, and he's gone on cable TV, made a lot of outlandish claims and been in a lot of controversy. And so it is plausible, and the department demonstrated that there were actual threats made on social media, some made directly to the department, that they took seriously and employed a lot of people to try to protect Clark. They said that deputies put in more than 6,000 hours watching Clark's house. And yeah, they say it's discontinued now. I guess for several reasons, we can all hope that it won't be necessary again.
And we leave it there. Rob, we'll talk to you next time.
All right. Thank you.
That was Robert Menser, senior statewide editor for USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He's with us almost every Friday to look back at the week's biggest state headlines. With archery deer season beginning this Saturday, the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab is urging hunters to test the deer they harvest for CWD. The reason some new studies out of Canada have shown that CWD may be transmitted to primates. Now, nobody knows yet whether this means humans can get CWD from infected deer meat, but new research seems to demonstrate that it's a possibility. Keith Polson is with us now. He's a veterinarian practicing at the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab and the School of Veterinary Medicine, Maury Wad Large Animal Hospital. He's also the director of outreach. Keith, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, first off, can you tell us about these new studies that show primates, some of them anyway, can get CWD?
Sure. And that's really what the purpose of the story that came out of University Communication that's been picked up is that this study out of Canada, which is in the peer review process right now, it's an abstract, but it's really the first of its kind that's shown that chronic wasting disease as a prion infection and a transmissible spongiform encephalopathy can be transmitted outside of the cervid species. We've known that cervids can pass it back and forth, and cervids being white-tailed deer, mule deer, elk, especially in Colorado. But this is the first that's shown oral consumption of infected deer meat by non-human primates to develop the prion disease.
Now, obviously, a monkey is different than a human being, but what does this study tell you about, you know, the possibility or the probability of a human being being able to,
right,
to get CWD?
Yeah. You know, this really highlights the fact that there is a lot of unknowns about this infection, just like many other infectious diseases. This being as such a novel finding, this really kind of points to the fact that we need to know more. There's not much research going on with CWD, basic science or pathophysiology. Mainly what we have going is epidemiological studies. And when you have something new like this, we need to repeat it, make sure that it's valid, and then we need to continue to investigate, because it's not only CWD happening in a vacuum with the white-tailed deer population. Anytime you have an infection, whether it's a virus, bacteria, or prion, we need to worry about how does that affect the rest of the ecosystem. You know, could it be animal health, human health, or environmental health? Because it's all kind of interconnected. And because of the deer hunting population or the deer hunting sport in Wisconsin is really part of our culture, as part of the Wisconsin economy, when we have new findings like this, we want to make sure that we get out ahead of it. We talk about it, and we provide as many resources as possible for our hunters in the state of Wisconsin.
Now, you've mentioned a couple of times now the word prions, which I understand are also related or could be a cause of dementia and other neurological diseases. And we've been hearing more about prions recently. Can you tell us what they are and what the concern is there?
Sure. So when we think of infectious pathogens, bacteria are pretty simple. We know bacteria kind of live normally. There's good bacteria, bad bacteria. Same thing with viruses, and viruses are a little bit smaller. And then if you continue along that kind of train of thought, prions are essentially a folded protein, and there are normal prions, just like normal bacteria. And then there's abnormal prions that cause mainly neurologic diseases. And so what happens is the protein folds differently, and then it causes pathology. And other options or other types of prion diseases out there that have been known for a long time are things like scrapie, which tends to affect sheep and sheep only, We've all heard of mad cow disease, and then there's a variant of that, mainly in the UK. There's a human disease, Creutzfeldt-Jakob's, and then there's CWD, which is relatively new on the scene, and comparing it relatively to the other diseases, where we're talking about 3 to 5 decades. And they tend to cause mainly neurologic disease by killing the neurons in the central nervous system. And when those neurons die, microscopically, it leaves small little holes, like a, which looks like a sponge in cross-section.
And why don't we know yet if humans can get CWD from eating infected meat? Seems like, you know, for instance, in Wisconsin, there must be a lot of hunters, maybe even before there was awareness raised about CWD, who've eaten infected meat.
Right. Great question. And that is part of the unknowns that we need to know some more about. So what we do know, thinking about it translatively in other species, and that's really kind of what we think about in the One Health perspective, is that not all species are affected by different infectious diseases the same. And for cervids, we know that white-tailed deer have a very short incubation time. So we think it's between 18 months and 2 years. And then you compare that to mule deer or elk, mainly in Colorado, and we know that's longer. That's 5 or 6 years. And that's well beyond the lifespan of the average white-tailed deer. Now, what does that mean in dairy cows, or what does it mean in people? It's unknown. Maybe we have a much longer incubation period, or maybe it just doesn't cross species or cross species yet. And those are some of the lessons that we're learning when we kind of think about other infectious agents as well, like flu. Flu is a prime example. Flu really is mainly species specific, and then we have a little bit of drift or shift in the nucleic acid makeup of that pathogen, and all of a sudden it changes. It goes from a low path to a highly pathogenic strain, or it goes from only in ducks to then being able to jump species into dogs or humans or horses. So that's some of the reasons why we really need to know a little bit more about it, or why haven't we seen people with it? Maybe it's a different incubation period, or maybe it really just doesn't change, and that would be the best case scenario. But as we continue to watch the disease, just like anything else, that could change. It might never change, but it could change in the future. And that's why we're really pushing or making sure that everyone knows of the programs that are available, because the DNR will test your deer for free. And most of that testing is done at the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab with a program that has been developed over several years. And that's how we know more, is by testing more animals, knowing more about the disease ecology, and then hopefully we can get enough public interest to maybe do some more basic science research on CWD.
Talking with Keith Polson right now with the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, talking about why he says hunters should get their deer checked for CWD this year. And Keith, the DNR is aware of this research and has opted not to change its message to hunters. They're sticking with what they've said before. They say if you harvest a deer from an area with CWD where it's prevalent, if you see deer that look emaciated or acting strangely, they discourage hunters from eating meat. But they haven't gone further than that. Do you think that's enough?
Well, we work very closely with DNR, and our recommendations are going to mirror exactly what DNR says, because really it's their program, and we're kind of an arm of that, and we're trying to utilize the university's outreach to be able to get more information out. What I would say is that the more we test, the more information we have. And public health is going to take the most conservative route and say you shouldn't consume a positive deer. And my own personal opinion, and that's really what it comes down to, is that really what is your own individual choice? The chances of a human being infected with CWD are very, very low, but they're not zero. And that's really important. And we hear that from Dan Storm and the National Wildlife Health Center, is that, you know, it's a really low chance, but it's not zero. So we need to know more about it, and really keeping that message consistent between DNR, public health, and we would follow that.
How many hunters usually do get the deer they harvest tested?
That really depends on where you are in the state and how easy it is to test. And then there's some other cultural, political beliefs about whether or not it's a real thing or not. I'd be on the side of this is a real issue that's affecting our herd. And it really depends on if you're in the southwest part of the state, it's really easy to get your deer tested. A much higher percentage of hunters will have their deer tested because they can bring it right to the Black Earth Testing Center. If let's say you're in a part of the state that's the testing center is a couple hours away or you don't have a veterinarian available to help you take the samples, it's going to be much, much less because people view it as a much lower risk, much lower prevalence. And that's fine. That's an individual choice. I think really what we're trying to push out is that here, go to the DNR's website, understand how and where you're tested. And from the diagnostic lab in Madison or Barron, what are your options there as well?
And Keith, as we wrap up, what would you like to see happen in terms of management of CWD and research going forward so we can gather more information?
It would always be great to have more money to do some research, but in the times of dwindling or scarce resources, we need to make sure we have as much information as possible. Right now, it's so many people can make their own educated choice, and we'd really like more deer tested so we can follow the disease and we know where the prevalence is changing throughout the state, because then it's much easier for the state and the university to dedicate those scarce resources to the places where we think we'd have the most efficacy or benefit.
Keith, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Keith Polson is with us, a veterinarian practicing at the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, also the School of Veterinary Medicine, Maury Wad Large Animal Hospital. And he says that this is the year hunters should be very serious about getting their deer checked for chronic wasting disease. Also, check out wiscontext.org for additional reporting on chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin's deer population. Now, healthcare coverage has been a divisive topic for years, but it reached a critical point following the passage of the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, in 2010. Now that Republicans control both houses in Congress and with President Trump in the White House, it seemed all but certain that the ACA would be repealed. However, Republicans in Congress haven't been able to agree on new legislation, and their first efforts failed. Right now, legislators are at work on three very different versions of healthcare legislation, from a single-payer plan to an Affordable Care Act fix and a final repeal and replace effort from Republicans. Philip Rocco joins us now. He's an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and the co-author of Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me, Veronica.
Well, let's start with the law as it currently stands. The Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, still law of the land. Can you give us a quick overview as to why it's had such sticking power, why it's been so hard to dismantle for Republicans, and why it's been such a sore spot for lawmakers?
Well, the Affordable Care Act was a law that I think many people call Obamacare, in part because it's associated primarily with a Democratic president and the Democratic Party. But I think what most people forget or is hard to remember is that the basic building blocks of the Affordable Care Act come from a sort of Republican template for health reform in the 1990s when President Clinton was promoting a health reform bill that ultimately failed. Republicans introduced a bill that looked a lot like what the Affordable Care Act currently is. And so I think that that partly accounts for why it's been difficult for Republicans to introduce some kind of alternative to the Affordable Care Act, because in a lot of ways, the things that they would have to do is gut parts of the law that are pretty consistent with what I think a lot of Republicans are okay with. It's fundamentally organized. The law is organized around markets. It provides some basic consumer protections, and I think that many of the parts of the law that would ultimately be gutted by the repeal and replace plans are, you know, not just politically popular, voters like them, But they're fairly consistent with what Republicans for a long time have actually been okay with.
And on the other hand, it's facing some obstacles in that the markets are not as stable as one would wish. Premiums have been going up quite a lot in some places. And we see right now a possible fix in that Washington Senator Patty Murray has been working with GOP colleagues across the aisle to try to stabilize markets. Can you tell us about that effort?
Yeah, so one of the challenges that I think Democrats, when they wrote the law, didn't necessarily imagine that they would face is that insurers really wouldn't find it as lucrative to be in the business of insuring people who had been sort of historically uninsured. Many of them were very sick. And this basically led in a number of states, especially in rural areas, where there wasn't necessarily a lot of business, that competition, which was supposed to drive down premiums, didn't really emerge. And there was some difficulty in sort of getting younger, healthier people to enroll. And so this sort of bipartisan effort that you see from senators like Patty Murray is kind of organized around doing things to incentivize insurers to come into the marketplace, kind of providing some payments for stabilization, which were initially in the Affordable Care Act but have been sort of removed over time, and trying to make basically prop up the system that exists.
So politically, how viable is that effort from Senator Murray and her GOP colleagues?
I think that it's probably doubtful that as a standalone piece of legislation, it's going to have the number of votes needed to get through the Senate. It is difficult to see how senators who have been on the record as, you know, supporting repeal and replace would have some kind of incentive, especially if they're facing a primary challenge from the right, in order to get on board with that effort. That being said, it's not necessarily the case that the sort of alternative Republican effort has that much support either. So it's kind of a neither nor sort of situation.
Right. Let's talk about that alternative plan in the GOP right now with a group including Senator Lindsey Graham co-sponsoring a bill that would change the Affordable Care Act, wouldn't be a full repeal. He gave a synopsis of his plan this week on CNN.
We're keeping the taxes in place on the wealthy. We're repealing the individual mandate, the employer mandate, the medical device tax that 75 senators voted to repeal. There's about $500 billion of money. Rather than trying to run health care from Washington, we're going to block grant it to the states. And here's what will happen. If you like Obamacare, you can reimpose the mandates at the state level. You can repair Obamacare if you think it needs to be repaired. You can replace it if you think it needs to be replaced. It'll be up to the governors. They've got a better handle on this than any bureaucrat in Washington.
And there's Senator Lindsey Graham talking about a new effort to overhaul the Affordable Care Act, relying heavily on block grants. And Senator Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson is also on board with this one, saying Republicans hadn't really given it their all, and this is, you know, one last Herculean effort. Where does this one stand?
So in terms of the policy, I think what Graham kind of fails to mention are three important things. First, the Cassidy Graham bill repeals the law's tax credits for middle-income Americans to help them pay for premiums. It also repeals the cost-sharing subsidies, which help people sort of pay doctors at the office or at the pharmacy counter. The bill also replaces those programs by allowing states to kind of come up with alternatives to the way that the Affordable Care Act works. But probably the most important thing that, you know, Graham kind of buries the lead is that the bill makes some pretty gigantic cuts to Medicaid and not the part of Medicaid that the Affordable Care Act expanded. One thing the law does is put a cap on Medicaid spending for children and non-disabled individuals that would cut, I think, about $175 billion from the program between 2020 and 2026. So that's kind of a big sleeper issue that, you know, has kind of been in Republican repeal and replace bills for a while, but is much less politically popular than anything else that's in there. And I think, you know, if the plan is going to have that element in it, I think it would be you're going to see some major political blowback.
And this plan would transfer a lot of power to the states themselves, who could decide what they wanted to do, as you said. Is that something that you think there's an appetite for among state houses?
That's a good question. One thing that I've been doing in my research recently is kind of looking what states are doing on their own to sort of make innovations in the healthcare delivery system and payment reform. And one thing that I've found is that states, even when there's a lot of energy and interest in kind of making significant reforms, many of the states where the reform is kind of most needed is also where state government doesn't necessarily have the capacity, including the capacity in kind of the bureaucracy to design and implement those reforms. And so even where there's a lot of interest on the part of voters and policymakers to kind of do things on their own, a lot of states just don't have the kind of raw materials to make it happen. And I think that, you know, you might imagine, if the Affordable Care Act is repealed, maybe that would generate a lot of interest and energy on the part of states. But it's not necessarily clear that states would be sort of ready on day one to make that happen.
We're talking to Philip Rocco right now. He's an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. And we're talking about the political battle over healthcare and how it could play out moving forward. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of some of the latest plans coming out of Washington that address healthcare? And by the way, when we come back, we will be talking about Bernie Sanders' push for single-payer health care as well. So yet another option in the works in Washington right now. Whether any of these are viable remains to be seen, but we want to know what you think. Do you think there's maybe a middle ground between the GOP and Democratic plans? Call us at 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about the ongoing battle over healthcare in the U.S. with Philip Rocco, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's walking us through three takes on healthcare legislation that are going on right now in Washington. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. We'll get to single payer in just a bit. What do you think of the various plans being floated for healthcare in our country? Do you think healthcare is a right or a privilege? And are you on board with any of these plans that we've talked about? A Republican overhaul, a fix to the Affordable Care Act with market stabilization, or, as we'll talk about, a single-payer plan being put forward by Senator Bernie Sanders. Let us know at 800-642-1234. And Philip, let's get to that single-payer plan. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders announced his Medicare for All plan. That's what he's calling it. So far, what do you know about this plan? What's in it?
So it would create a single-payer system of healthcare. And for people who don't know what that is, a single-payer system is a healthcare system where the government, kind of financed by taxes, covers healthcare costs for everyone in the country, regardless of their income or occupation or health status. So single-payer systems, by definition, eliminate other ways that people receive health insurance. And so Bernie Sanders, this sort of single-payer plan, combines, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, employer-sponsored insurance, TRICARE, which provides health insurance to military families. It leaves, like, the VA system intact and the Indian Health Service intact, but it combines all of these systems into one plan. And what it does is offer health care to people without any out-of-pocket spending or copays or emergency room visits. Basically, consumers wouldn't be liable for any out-of-pocket spending except for prescription drugs.
And in an announcement earlier this week, Sanders said that one part of the Medicare for All plan would be to negotiate more with private companies. And here's what he had to say.
We tell the drug companies that the American people are sick and tired of the greed of the pharmaceutical industry. We are no longer going to get ripped off and pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs on the Medicare for All. We're going to negotiate.
Now, Phil, based on what I've seen, what I've read, this plan is more or less dead on arrival. On the other hand, Bernie Sanders is widely believed to be running in 2020, so he could be priming the pump here. What do you think of the prospects of this one?
Well, I think the plan, I agree with you that in the current political context, and even under, I think, a better political context, would probably be dead on arrival. Most importantly, the plan doesn't actually develop a set of rationales for how it would pay for a sort of expansive single-payer health system. But I think what Sanders is doing here, and he's incredibly savvy at this, is trying to change the nature of the debate over health reform. Right? The debate we've been having for about the last few years is a debate over whether or not we should repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, which was a health plan that's sort of built with a Republican blueprint. And what Sanders is trying to do is to kind of pull the debate further towards something that is a much more, I think, visible, tangible health reform that actually an increasing number of Americans who believe that the government should have some role in providing health care think it should be through single payer. So I think what he's trying to do is recognizing that it's probably politically infeasible, certainly at the moment, he's trying to change the nature of the debate that we're having over health reform.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Todd joining us in Appleton. Todd, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I just have always felt like the government really shouldn't be involved in healthcare. And what I've seen, you know, at the VA and other things like that kind of confirms my feelings about that. But the other thing about Senator Sanders, recently had a Canadian doctor on his radio show, and she was explaining to him, you know, that, oh, yeah, the healthcare works well. And then until, you know, if you got like headaches and it's not an emergency situation, then we might not see you for 6 months. So if you need a knee replacement, you might not be for a year. You might not get a hip replacement for a year. So, you know, everything was going along smoothly until all of a sudden, you know, people start waking up and going, wait a minute, this is a whole bureaucratic nightmare that's going to just cost you a lot of grief.
Todd, thank you so much for that. And that is something that Americans have heard when we get into the health care nitty-gritty, that the care in Canada, maybe you have to wait a long time for it. Maybe it is paid for by the government, but there are drawbacks. And is this something that's going to be part of the debate?
Yeah, I think Todd is right on the money in saying that this sort of the absence of trust in government in the United States is a huge barrier, a political barrier that, you know, if this plan is going to get off the ground, it's going to have to deal with, right? One of the reasons why Obamacare looks the way that it does, and so many other programs in American government look the way they do, right, finance through taxation, kind of relying on markets, is that, you know, when you talk to Americans about building a big bureaucratic system for administering policy, Americans are not usually too predisposed to like that. So I think the challenge that Sanders faces is trying to shift the terms of the debate by saying, well, defend the system that we currently have, right? Everyone's afraid of a bureaucratic nightmare from a new government program. But what about the bureaucratic nightmare that people face when they try to get coverage now? I think many of the problems that, you know, when you ask people what do they dislike about their health care, the one thing that you kind of hear in interviews and surveys is that it's really confusing. And, you know, you don't know who you have access to. You don't know what prices you're going to ultimately pay. And if you're, you know, leaving a job, you're not sure where your health care is going to come from next and what the premiums are going to be. And I think that Sanders has got to put defenders of the current system kind of on the defensive if he wants to overcome this problem. Whether or not that will translate into a miraculous, you know, development of public trust in government, you know, maybe not. But he's certainly, that's the rhetorical, I think, task that he's got in front of him.
And Philip, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks.
That was Philip Rocco, an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, also the co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act, joining us there to talk about the ongoing political battle over health care in the United States. Republican lawmakers could vote as soon as today to approve a state budget that would cut funding for major highway projects. 20 years ago, they might have increased the gas tax to prevent those cuts, but the idea never took hold in today's Wisconsin's Republican Party. Sean Johnson reports.
In September of 1997, Wisconsin's state budget was late. One of the hang-ups was transportation funding. A group of rank-and-file Republicans had blocked the gas tax increase in the previous budget, and they were fighting it again. But Republican leadership cut a deal with Democrats.
Then the proposal increases the gas tax by 1 cent beginning on November 1 of 1997. Obviously, that was not the Assembly Republican position, but that is the compromise proposal.
There was some grumbling from Republicans when then-Assembly Majority Leader Scott Jensen announced the gas tax would go up by a penny. Even so, it passed overwhelmingly. 20 years later, the budget is late again, and lawmakers spent months discussing road funding. But the parallels between 1997 and 2017 end there. Back then, Wisconsin's Republican governor was Tommy Thompson. He signed two gas tax increases and saw the gas tax go up automatically almost a dozen times through Wisconsin's gas tax indexing law, which has since been repealed. Now, Wisconsin's Republican governor is Scott Walker. He set the table for this year's transportation debate by issuing a warning to lawmakers before his budget was even introduced.
I will veto any changes made to the budget that add to the overall burden of the taxpayers of this state.
Walker's Department of Transportation secretary at that time was Mark Gottlieb, a former Republican lawmaker, a civil engineer, and a longtime advocate for increasing taxes or fees to pay for roads. But just when the road funding debate was heating up, Gottlieb resigned. And Walker picked a replacement with a different worldview.
You know, I have a question for the politicians. How much of our money do you want?
Former Superior Mayor Dave Ross revved up the crowd at a 2009 Tea Party rally when he said politicians lacked the backbone to balance budgets without raising taxes.
What they want to do is they want to turn us into a state of tax slaves run by a ruling class of politicians who have forgotten that they are the people's servants. Thank you.
When Ross took over as transportation secretary, he said Wisconsin had a spending problem with roads, not a revenue problem. 20 years ago, groups like the Road Builders more consistently got what they wanted. Now they're at odds with the conservative organization Americans for Prosperity. AFP Wisconsin Director Eric Bott says his group organized phone banks and knocked on doors to fight the gas tax.
You know, legislators don't do or not do something because I say so or my staff say so. They do it because they hear from hundreds or thousands of their constituents back home.
Only 11 current legislators were serving the last time the state voted to raise the gas tax. Whitewater Republican Steve Noss was there. He voted against it. Noss says lawmakers like him have more of a voice now, because there's simply more of them in Wisconsin state government.
Absolutely, no question. And as more like-minded people come to the Senate, I think that you'll see a continuation of wanting to reform government.
Lawmakers who wanted to increase taxes or fees for roads say they're disappointed. They're willing to fight that fight again 2 years from now. But there's little evidence to suggest that the Republican lawmakers, groups, and governor who fought this gas tax hike would see the issue differently in the next budget. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.